Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the St. Louis Collaborative Family Law Association podcast, where attorneys, mental health, and financial professionals talk about divorce and other family law matters. CFLA is a network of professionals committed to providing a respectful, supportive, and non-adversarial process to resolve disputes and family matters.
Hello, and welcome to Episode 9, The Role of the Mental Health Professional in Family Law Cases. Today, we're talking with Allison Gurley, an attorney, and Rebecca Groh, a licensed clinical social worker. Allison is an attorney with the Center for Family Law with offices in Clayton and St. Charles. She's been with the firm for over 5 years and graduated from University of Missouri, Kansas City School of Law. Allison's practice is devoted to family law. In addition to her training in collaborative law, Allison is trained as a guardian ad litem and a mediator. Rebecca Groh is a licensed clinical social worker in private practice in the Central West End in St. Louis. Her practice is dedicated to working with children, kids, teens, and their parents. Her clients come to her for help with anxiety, parent-child conflict, or traumatic experiences, as well as help coping with parents' separation or divorce. Rebecca is also trained in collaborative law. And I'm Cynthia Garnholz with the Garnholz Law Firm in St. Louis. I'm a collaborative family law attorney in practice for over 30 years and a founding member of the Collaborative Family Law Association of St. Louis. I believe collaborative practice is the best way to achieve lasting peace for parents and children after divorce. Well, Allison Gurley and Rebecca Groh, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So I'd like both of you to talk a little bit about how and why you selected this topic for today's podcast. Beginning with you, Allison, can you tell us why?
Absolutely. So in my practice and also in talking to other attorneys and mental health professionals, I found that there tends to be a lot of confusion about the role in which the mental health professional takes on in our cases. And that confusion is not only with the parties, but often at times even the attorneys about what the role is of that mental health professional and what exactly we are hoping, expecting them to do in the case, and making sure that that role is clearly defined in any court order to help give everyone direction as they move forward working with that professional.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. Rebecca, what about you?
Yeah, that does make a lot of sense, Allison, and I think I would echo really the same motivation for myself on the mental health professional side of things. I noticed that there is a lot of confusion in and among sort of the non-mental health professionals or sort of the lawyers or even the judges sometimes, and certainly with the families who are involved in the court process about the different names, the different licenses, and the different sort of goals and trajectories of mental health professionals and the mental health process, especially when there's a parallel or there's like sort of a co-occurring legal process going on. And it's really important because it has a big impact on those families' lives. So it's good to try to iron it out.
So I think I agree completely. There is a lot of confusion. So maybe we could start off by explaining the different roles that a mental health professional can have in a family law case. Allison, can you help us with that?
Absolutely. So I'm going to start by explaining the role of the mediator, an evaluator, parenting coordinator, mental health professional's role in collaborative cases, and also explain the role of a guardian ad litem, a term that is often used and can get confusing for people unfamiliar with the process. So to start, we'll talk about a mediator. And this is a neutral person who parties can agree to go to before even filing anything with the court or after attorneys have been involved. A mediator can be an attorney or a mental health professional, and that person is there to meet with the individuals, jointly, always. Sometimes there might be phone calls one-on-one, and work through their issues, assisting them, and hopefully reaching an agreement. That agreement might be on property or, let's say, child support or custody. It doesn't necessarily have to be an agreement on all issues, but to try to work through whatever issues are there for a case. The mediator is not on either person's side, nor is the mediator either party's therapist. The mediator is there to facilitate the process of reaching that agreement. Next, we have an evaluator. This is typically a psychologist appointed to perform an evaluation of one party or multiple parties. The scope of the evaluation is typically defined by a court order. We could do a psychological evaluation of one party, multiple parties, a custody evaluation, which would include evaluations of the parents and the family as a whole, or you might have an evaluation for purposes of determining someone's alcohol or substance abuse addiction issues as well. With any of the evaluations, the evaluator may talk to other therapists and other mental health professionals treating a party or a member of the family. In addition, there might be medical records provided to that evaluator. For custody evaluations, that would also include psychological evaluations of each party and typically all of the children. There might be observations of visits between the parents and the children. There would be third-party interviews, review of any records, conversation with those mental health professionals, in addition to the psychological testing. And then based on all of that information, the custody evaluator would then make a recommendation as to custody. It sort of takes those psychological evaluations one step further and discussing how any potential diagnoses would impact a parent's ability to parent a child, or how a diagnosis in a child might need particular parenting that one parent may have or may not have. It's not a confidential process at all, and so all that information would be shared. Next, we have the parenting coordinator. This can be a mental health professional or an attorney with mediation training appointed to assist high-conflict parents. The parenting coordinator is typically appointed after a case is over to help implement a parenting plan and monitor and ensure compliance by the parties and to resolve conflicts. It's sort of a quasi-legal mental health and alternative dispute resolution process. It's also not a confidential one. Next, we have mental health professionals on collaborative cases. And the main role that a mental health professional plays, and a very important role, is as the divorce coach. It could be one coach or a two-coach model, meaning that each party would have their own coach, or they both meet with the same individual. And that person is there to meet one-on-one with the parties and also be present at team meetings with the other professionals, works to develop a parenting plan and identify and prioritize concerns of each party, make effective use of conflict resolution and communication skills. It is not individual therapy, but there to help get clients through the collaborative process, get them through their divorce, and talk through all the many, you know, concerns and just emotions that arise when you're going through something that difficult. It is not a confidential process within the collaborative team, meaning that the things discussed one-on-one can be shared with the attorneys or the other party, but it is confidential to people outside of the collaborative process. Another role for a mental health professional in a collaborative case is as a child specialist. That person would be there to meet one-on-one with the child and attend those team meetings and to bring the voice of the child to the parents during, you know, the team meetings on one-on-one meetings and make sure that that voice is being taken into consideration as the parties work through a parenting plan. So in Missouri, we in order to be a guardian ad litem, you do have to be an attorney. In other states, that might also be a mental health professional. But in Missouri, you do have to be an attorney, and you're there as a legal representative of the child. That is correct.
Is that a court-appointed position? Okay.
Yes. Thank you for clarifying that. But you are there as a legal representative of the child appointed by the court to interview the parents and other third parties in addition to meeting with the child or children and to make recommendations to the court about what is in the child's best interest. Often, the guardian ad litem has an integral role in talking to other mental health professionals that might be involved on a case. And so I think that it gets brought up quite a bit, and it will get brought up in our conversation here today, but it is important to note that that person is not a mental health professional.
Wow, that was a great explanation, Allison. Rebecca, is there anything you want to add to that?
Well, yeah, thank you. I think I'm going to talk about some different mental health professionals that might appear in or be brought up in conversations for families that are involved in the court process. But importantly, I want to just kind of summarize that Allison explained the roles of professionals who are court appointed and who fit into sort of a separate but parallel process of mental health in which they have a predetermined goal of some kind, a goal to produce a document, to resolve a specific custody question, and there's sort of that end point. And there's also, relevantly, because of that final product, there's a limited and reduced expectation on the part of the family for confidentiality in their interactions with those court-appointed mental health professionals. And that's something that will be important for the family to be aware of and for the mental health professionals to clarify.
So you mean that a judge could see the interaction between the mental health professional and the family?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if, for example, in a psychological evaluation or a custody evaluation, the evaluation is a written document that's going to be submitted to some representative of the court. And so other people are going to see the results of that.
That's important to know.
That doesn't mean that just it is important to know. That doesn't mean that just anybody can see it, but other people will be seeing it.
Yes.
I'm going to talk now about some other mental health professionals or mental health services that a family who's involved with the family court might be getting services from. And they're in this other parallel lane of providing therapeutic services, providing counseling. So one of those processes is family therapy. Family therapy helps members of a family system, so parents and children, including all the siblings, for example, identify and resolve relational systemic problems that affect the family unit and the members of the family. So a family therapist is trained to take a very relational and very systemic view of what's going on with the family to try to create positive change for that family. In family therapy, the client is the whole family system, and each member of that family system, their perspective, their needs, and interests are going to be prioritized equally in the therapeutic process. Typically, because of that, in a session for family therapy, you would have all family members present. I'll talk a little bit about licensing. There are lots of different kinds of mental health professionals that could provide family therapy: a licensed psychologist, a licensed clinical social worker, a licensed professional counselor, certainly a licensed marriage and family therapist, as well as, truthfully, some therapeutically trained psychiatrists, even though we traditionally at this point think of psychiatrists as providing medication. There are psychiatrists that provide actual therapy sessions. Individual therapy is different than family therapy. In individual therapy, a therapist works with one person, and that one person is the identified client. And it's that person's perspective and, in fact, their identification of problems or goals that's going to be the focus of treatment. And the in individual therapy, again, you're trying to create long-term, sustainable, positive change for that person. And I would say that most mental health professionals are really working from, an empowerment perspective in which you want that person to have some self-determination as to what positive change would be for them. Sometimes an individual therapist will meet or talk to other people that are important to their client's life, but typically sessions are one-on-one, therapist to client. And if they are talking to somebody else, they would need to be doing so with the authorization and permission of that client. Because, again, in these therapy providing processes, there is a significant expectation of confidentiality. Now, part of the goal setting process in individual therapy for an adult can be informed heavily by some special circumstances. So, for example, sometimes an adult enters voluntarily or is court ordered or required to participate in drug and alcohol treatment or anger management treatment. And in that context, the focus of treatment is going to be on addressing concerns related to drug and alcohol abuse, or handling one's anger in a more safe or effective manner. But the therapy will also be taking into account the contributing factors to the possible problems with alcohol or drugs or anger. And so goals certainly will involve addressing those aforementioned concerns, but they might involve things before that in order to do that, such as processing a traumatic event or handling difficulties in peer relationships. Another kind of therapy that it often comes up in families that are involved with the family court process is child therapy. And I will say that I'm especially fond of this one because this is what I tend to do during my days in the office. In child therapy, a therapist aims to help children, kids, whatever the age of that young person, deal with difficulties in their lives. Those difficulties could include things like that we think of as more internal, like anxiety or depression. It can also be helping a child adjust in appropriate and sort of developmentally conscious way to the things that are going on around them, or enhance their relationships with people around them. And in this setting, the child is the client. Some therapists will see a child in the session individually. So it can kind of look like individual therapy in that way, and that the session is mostly one-on-one, the child and the therapist. Some therapists, myself included, will mix and match some of the sessions depending on the child's needs. So, for example, many children can't get to their appointments without an adult, and typically that adult is a parent or caregiver. So there might be a check-in that the therapist has with the parent or caregiver about some of the things that have gone on during the week or since the last appointment, or some of the things that are going on in the court process to help that therapist know about some of the things the child cannot be expected to know about. Some child therapists will have conjoint sessions, and this can look a little bit like family therapy because you'll have the child and the parent together in a session working on something. But it's different than family therapy because the focus is always on the needs, the interests, the voice, and the perspective of that child, and that's really important. Child therapy or child therapists should also know that children are kind of at the they're reliant on adults. And so the goals that a child therapist might set with the family or the child involved in child therapy will be informed by the parents and by the legal guardians. And many child therapists will take extra steps in the assessment process and throughout therapy to seek authorization from those guardians, the child's guardians, to communicate with other important people like teachers or pediatricians to make sure they're getting a full picture of what's going on with the child.
And it's what the child shares with the therapist shared also with the parents?
That's a really great question. So legally speaking, and Allison can certainly jump in here if she has a different take on it, but a minor child does not have the same privilege of confidentiality that an adult does, in the sense that their parents, their legal guardians, have a right to access their records. Now, I've never had a parent demand that they be present for every session and every conversation. And truthfully, if that did happen, that would give me some pause. And I would want to explore why. Because while legally kids don't have a right to the same level of confidentiality from their parents, they do need to have a reasonable expectation of trust in their therapeutic relationship with their therapist. And so therapy can't really be helpful or productive, and in fact can be harmful to a child if they are set up to believe that they can speak in confidence with their therapist, or if they're sort of pressured to speak openly with their therapist by, hopefully not the therapist, and by people outside of the process, and then later find out that in fact the therapist has been just communicating everything with their parents, even things that the child felt really uncomfortable with that parent knowing.
Interesting.
Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So an important part of the therapeutic process for a child therapist to have or to initiate with the family, especially in cases where there's like a custody disagreement or a high conflict parent dynamic, is to really set those expectations clearly from the outset. How can we make this work? How can we make sure that we're looking after the interests of your child, and this is the person you are bringing here to get help for them? Of course, your mom or your dad, and you care about what's going on. How can we make sure that you're informed while also making sure that this process has some integrity and that this process has a reasonable expectation of being successful? Moving sort of, you know, sort of, I guess I'm trying to do an umbrella and sort of moving down the umbrella to talk about parent coaching. Parent coaching is an interesting one to try to define. A parent coach is somebody who helps coach parents in how to parent effectively. So typical goals in parent coaching might include things like setting reasonable expectations based on the child's developmental age or developmental abilities. So there would be some education given to the parent about what we can expect this child to do, especially if there's sort of a mismatch between the expectation and the reality. Another example of a common parent coaching goal might be to come up with effective, safe, appropriate behavior management strategies. What do we do when, you know, Julia refuses to comply with your directives? This is the problem that many parents face. And so parent coaching actually is a really common part of child therapy. But sometimes parent coaching kind of jumps outside of the child's therapy context and is something that a parent coach is providing directly and exclusively to the parents of the child. So in this case, the child's not involved in the session, and the sessions are taking place just with the parents. So defining the client in parent coaching can be a little bit tricky, and it depends on the context in which the therapist is working. Is that therapist also the child therapist, and so some of the sessions are actually educational sessions for the parent. There's a lot of evidence base to support the utility of that, and I can say from my own experience that it's very important. But it might also be the case that the therapist is saying, my clients here are the parents because they're the only ones that I'm talking to or working with. The beneficiary of parent coaching, however, is always the child, always primarily the child. And then, of course, you see some sort of residual positive impacts on the parents because things are going better.
Okay, that's wonderful information.
Oh. Yeah.
Rebecca, we're getting a little short on time. If you don't mind, I'm just going to segue real quickly to if we could talk a little more about the role of mental health professionals in collaborative cases. Allison, what do you think about the role of the mental health professional in a collaborative case and how they can impact the client?
So I previously discussed broadly just whether, you know, that would be a divorce coach or as a child specialist. But in terms of comparing that to their roles in more litigated cases, I think they have a huge impact in the collaborative process. Going through a divorce or other family law matter is an extremely emotional situation. You are grieving the loss of your spouse and that family, what that family meant to you, and as you create a new family. And so having mental health professionals integral in this process of divorcing and helping work one-on-one with the parties, and also there to, as a child specialist, to share the voice of the child and in making those decisions is huge. Often in litigated cases, the role of the mental health professional may not, it goes through the guardian ad litem and then to the guardian ad litem to everyone else. And there can be lots of confusion. And I think that through the collaborative process, it has a more direct impact and more easily heard by everyone. It also helps, I think, parties separate out their emotions versus maybe making more logical decisions. So if I can work through why I'm upset about something one-on-one with my divorce coach so that when I'm in that group setting, I am prepared, better prepared to advocate for myself and the reasons why I might want to keep the house, for example, or why I believe it's important for me to, let's say, have this car or a portion of the retirement account. Instead of having those discussions motivated by emotion, or at least as much motivated by emotion, I believe the divorce coach's role helps people kind of separate that out and be more productive in being able to negotiate for themselves.
Well, thank you so much for that. Rebecca Groh and Allison Gurley, thank you both for sharing your wisdom on this topic. It was a lot of fantastic information, and I know that people will really appreciate from you. Thanks again.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the St. Louis Family Law Association podcast. The information given in this episode is general in nature and may not apply to your particular situation. The information given is not meant to serve as legal advice. If you need legal advice, you may need to see a lawyer in your own jurisdiction. The choice of an attorney is an important decision and should not be based solely on advertisements. Visit stlewiscollaborativelaw.com for more information about this topic or to contact a collaborative family law professional today.